So in Sylvia Plath's novel, The Bell Jar, she has an image she creates about a fig tree. And her main character, Esther Greenwood, sees kind of her life as staring at a fig tree. And on the fig tree, the actual figs represent all the different paths she can go. And so she sees, you know, one fig is being married and having children. Okay? She sees another fig as, you know, potentially being a famous poet. She sees another fig as being, you know, a professor and living the academic life. Another one as, you know, world traveler. She sees all these options. And the problem is, though, is there's so many possible options, she doesn't know which one to pick. And she's in turmoil of how do I decide which route to go and what's the best thing to do with my life. And what she ends up doing in this sort of image she's created is she ends up staring at the tree and just starving because she can't pick a fig, to the point where the figs start to dry up and die and fall off. So it's, you know, it's kind of a very depressing image, but we're going somewhere more positive with this. But I wanted to just point that out to kind of show, I think a lot of us, you know, can be overwhelmed with, like, there's so many things you can do in life, so many choices you can make. What do you spend, you know, your time on life doing? I know for me it's something I think about. People ask me, you know, what's my most valuable possession? I would say my time, you know, because I'm always very, like, finicky about it. I want to make sure I'm always, like, productive with my time and I'm using it the best, you know, to my ability and so on and so forth. So it's definitely something I think about a lot. Oh, that's the wrong way. So I really like the book Ecclesiastes, which is what I preached on last time. I'm not preaching on it again, but it's kind of a follow-up, so I do want to just touch briefly on what I talked about last time, because Ecclesiastes is sort of about this idea. Okay, Solomon, who we presume to be the author of Ecclesiastes, was also really concerned about this idea of, like, how should I live my life? And so he writes this book where he takes a very philosophical approach to it. He sort of wants to study what's really actually not what do you do, but more what should you not do is kind of his focus. And he uses logic to kind of determine what is a vanity? Okay, what's in vain? What's a... but that's okay. yeah, it was all depressing anyway, so it only gets more positive for me. So we're talking about Ecclesiastes here, and kind of this idea of Solomon trying to use logic to prove what's not worth spending time on. What is a vanity? And so, come on. Correct. Only one technological thing can work at a time here? Oh, is it not?
Try it out.
Hey, there.
Okay. So, Solomon talks about a handful of things, but really two of the biggest ones is pleasure and work, and kind of like how we think about this. And so, with pleasure, over here, he says sort of, it's almost like a science experiment. He says, I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure, enjoy yourself. And he wants to see, like, what is this going to bring to my life? And so he kind of goes through, I'm not going to do the whole, like, all the quotes, but he goes through talking about, like, laughter and, you know, just having a good time, alcohol, success, material possessions, money, sex. And he's, you know, at the end of it, he's going to sit back then and kind of look at his results, observe it, draw conclusions. And he says, then I considered all that my hands had done and the toil I had expended doing it, and behold, all was a vanity and a striving after the wind, and there was nothing to be gained under the sun. So, translation, he says, pleasure is fleeting, okay? You might enjoy it in the moment, but then when it's over, he's sort of looking at scientifically, what did I gain? Nothing. That lasted for a moment. There's no long-term significance to just living your life devoted to getting pleasure, okay? So he looks at work, okay? He says, I made great works. I built houses and planted vineyards for myself. I made myself gardens and parks and planted them in them all kinds of fruit trees. I made myself pools from which to water the forest of growing trees. How did this work out for him? I hated all my toil, which I toil under the sun, seeing that I must leave it to the man who will come after me. And who knows whether he will be wise or a fool. And once again, what's his conclusion? You can't take it with you, okay? So he spent this whole life trying to make these amazing things because he wants them to last and just be so important. But he's like, wait a minute, when I die, I'm gone. And who knows what what's going to happen with those. Okay, there's no long-term significance to this. He also talks about how, like, and if you're trying to, like, build your legacy, if you're living so your name will be remembered, he kind of goes into detail about how no name's going to be remembered forever either, so that's not really a great answer to the issue. So, today, though, I'm not really going to talk on that because I did a sermon last year all about that. I want to do the second half because I kind of, that's the negative side of the issue, right? That's what not to do. And I kind of left you hanging there with, okay, well, now we know it's not worth pursuing. Yeah, exactly. For a year, you guys have been sitting in the wait, just wondering what you're sitting in front of the fig tree, right? You know which figs not to grab. No. Today, I want us to think a little bit about, like, what should we do? How then should we live? And, just some opening thoughts before I go more in detail. I think it's interesting to think about, like, what does creation tell us? The Genesis story. And I think it's significant you look at it. We were created in God's image. We were asked to care for the garden. And we are meant to be in relationship with God. And I think that's a large statement, sort of, for what our lives are supposed to be. Care for the world and be in relationship with God. And I think that's, sort of what should guide us. One of my favorite theologians, N.T. Wright, I like the way he puts it in his book, Paul for Everyone. He says, human beings were made to know, worship, love, and serve the Creator God. That always was and always will be the way to healthy and fruitful human living. And I think, though, he singles out worship as one of many of those, but I actually like the way my other favorite theologian, Frederick Buechner, puts it. He kind of considers it all worshiping. And this is a kind of long quote here, but I really like this. He says, to worship means to serve him. Basically, there are two ways to do it. One way is to do things for him that he needs to have done. Run errands for him, carry messages for him, fight on his side, feed his lambs, and so on. The other way is to do things for him that you need to do. Sing songs for him, create beautiful things for him, give things up for him, tell him what's on your mind and in your heart. In general, rejoice in him and make a fool of yourself for him the way lovers have always made fools for themselves for the ones they love. And so I think that's sort of the frame of this sermon I want it to be, is that it's all a form of worship. When we think about it the right way, whether we're praising God or doing work for God or serving him, like, that's all a form of worship. And that's kind of what I want us to think about how we should be living. Okay? But one of the things I'm going to talk about is how that word worship kind of probably has a broader meaning than we might typically think. So I'm going to use something from, once again, N.T. Wright here that I just really like, and it's sort of the foundation of this sermon. It's from his book, Surprised by Hope. And he was sort of, his whole book kind of builds up to this end where he kind of talks about what should we do? What are the things we should be focusing on? And he has three things. He talks about justice, beauty, and evangelism. And I guess it's important to know kind of why he feels these three things in particular. I'm not going to go super in detail. If you're interested, there's like 120 pages at the beginning of the book that he goes in detail, supporting his argument on this. But basically, he thinks it's really important to understand that the new heavens and the new earth, when Jesus comes back again, is going to be physically created from what we have here. That our bodies are going to be used to create our new bodies. That our earth, our present world is going to be created to create, sorry, is going to be used to create the new world. And to him, that makes everything different. To him, this means when we're on, our time on this earth does have a purpose because it's all preparing the way. Okay, and that's something I'll go into more detail. But he has another quote here. I do want to read another long one, but I like it. Every act of love, gratitude, and kindness. Every work of art or music inspired by the love of God and delight in the beauty of his creation. Every minute spent teaching a handicapped child to read or walk. Every act of care and nurture, of comfort and support for one's fellow human beings, and for that matter, for one's fellow non-human creatures, and every course of prayer, all spirit-led teaching, every deed that spreads the gospel, builds up the church, embraces and embodies holiness rather than corruption, and makes the name of Jesus honored in the world, all of this will find its way through the resurrecting power of God into the new creation that God will one day make. So I think that's a very empowering statement of, it's not exactly quite, and I'll connect it back to Ecclesiastes, but it's not exactly like this is all pointless, okay? But it's there's a sort of shift in mindset that you have to think about to go from Solomon's sort of, you know, if you're building up these great things, it's worthless, or if you're just trying to find pleasure, it's worthless, and that's kind of what I want to show the difference here. So I'm just going to go through each three. Evangelism, actually, I'm not really going to spend much time on. I feel like it's pretty self-explanatory. If you feel like God is the way to personal fulfillment and justice in this world, you're probably going to want to tell people about it. I mean, that's, you know, that's important. I'm just going to move, stepping on it. So there's a lot still to be said about evangelism. It could be, you know, a sermon on its own, but I kind of want to focus on the other two because those are the two that were most, I think, starkly contrasted with Ecclesiastes 1 that I could point out. So justice. After reading Ecclesiastes, one of the potentially dangerous responses is I was like, okay, he's really saying don't be so obsessed with, like, your work and don't get too into thinking you have to build this and do these things and all that. Which overall, for most people, that's a good warning, you know, but you can also then think, well, is anything worth working towards? You know, I remember thinking, like, I legitimately, sounds ridiculous, but I legitimately thought to myself, like, well, you know, Martin Luther King and St. Francis of Assisi worked super hard and spent a lot of time and sweat and tears to do what they were doing. Is that just grasping at the wind? You know, is that just a vanity? Should they not have been spending so much time on that? And I would say that Wright says emphatically, no, he does not think that that is a vanity. Because there's a key distinction between what they're doing and what Solomon is talking about when he was testing things. Wright would say that part of what we need to do to prepare the way is to set the world right, to bring justice. And I still think there's an important distinction in there. He calls it living between the resurrection and the second coming. Is that we can't think that we're going to fix everything. Obviously, as humans, we're not going to completely set the world right. There's a reason why Jesus came and died for us and why he's going to come back again to fully bring justice. But he does, I think, feel really passionately about warning against this idea of, well, we live here and let's just get by and whatever, and when we go to heaven, it'll be good. And just forget about what we do on earth. And he really, you know, feels that's a dangerous thing. He thinks that it is our duty to help prepare the way. We can't do it all, but we live between the resurrection and the second coming, and our duty as humans is to help bring as much justice as we can to prepare that second creation from coming back. Okay, and he has a quote about this. Oh, no, I was going to say first, actually. Oops, I'm a little behind here. So I think it's interesting to note the Lord's Prayer kind of touches on that, right? It says, "Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven." And so I think there's a clear sense that there is something worth doing here on earth, that we do need to try to bring his kingdom here on earth as it is in heaven. So I have a little biblical support, you know, to look to see what do they have to say about this issue. And Paul has some thoughts, and I think it's really interesting. He says, "Therefore, my beloved brothers, be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that in the Lord your labor is not in vain." And I love that he uses the word vain there, because that is the word that Solomon uses all the time in Ecclesiastes. I tend to think maybe that's intentional. He's really hammering it to the point home that it's not a vanity when you work for the Lord, okay? And I want to compare this with that Ecclesiastes thing now to show the difference. I've bolded here to notice what is Solomon working for here. He says, "I built houses and planted vineyards for myself. I made myself gardens and parks, and planted them in all kinds of fruit trees. I made myself pools from which to water the forest of growing trees." So I think when you look closely, Solomon isn't saying, don't spend time working on things, don't spend time trying to, build anything on this earth and work towards anything. He's saying that in a world, in a me-centered world in which you're not focused on God and his kingdom, but you're trying to, you know, create something for yourself, when you're trying to say, how best can I satisfy myself? Can I work and do make great things and, you know, bring true fulfillment through that? He's saying that is not possible. He's trying to logically break down that concept. If your only goal is just to be remembered or to have these great things that, you know, people can look at and say, oh, yeah, Jason's awesome. That's really impressive. That's going to be fleeting. But we do see that biblical writers say when you're working for the Lord, though, it's not a thing. That is totally worthwhile and worth spending time on. And I think you know, I think we can all find ways to do this. You know, we all do it in different ways. Whether your job you feel like has a component of that, or you work in outside ministries, you know, outside of your job, or you go to the polls and you feel like that's part of your way of bringing justice in the world, or maybe you're doing all of that stuff, we can all do it, okay? And I wanted to just highlight, especially this weekend, it's very timely for this sermon, See You at Home. You know, everything that Melanie's been working for and that she does, and One More Tonight, and everybody else who's involved, that's just such a powerful quality thing. And we don't want to look at that and, you know, say that that's a vanity. I mean, that's absolutely a powerful step that all of us are taking to bring justice in the world and to prepare the way for the second coming. You know, looking at Bill, Zach, and Seth there, who were staying out in a box that night, when you look at the smiles on their face and just kind of, you know, if you were out there and you got to see kind of what was going on, that's great stuff. You know, I just thought that was really fitting that as I was writing this sermon, we had One Winter Night and had such a poignant example of the power of, you know, working towards bringing justice and how positive that can be. It's just one of many, you know, potential examples, though. Here's the one that really floored me.
That picture was not for beauty.
Well, yeah. I don't know, Bill. I wasn't there. So, beauty here. This one, like I said, this one actually, it might seem weird, but this one totally surprised me in some ways. I wouldn't say, like, I have very much baggage from, like, a Christian upbringing, although I know sometimes there's baggage that comes along with it. But I would say that sometimes, like, I feel this sense of guilt if I'm not being productive, and if, like, God wants me to always be productive. And so the idea of, like, stopping and spending time to just enjoy beauty, kind of like, yeah, like, it can make me feel guilty. I mean, don't get me wrong, I do love enjoying things that are beautiful. I love a well-crafted movie, an elegantly written sentence, the green hills of Ireland. You know, I love a bounce pass that just slips past the outstretched arms of a defender. That's all great stuff. But the problem was that when something, you know, I'd always have this part of me back there that was like, but I can't spend too much time on this, right? And when I'm doing this, I'm like, oh, I'm taking a break from what I should be doing, but I need to get back to what matters. And so when N.T. Wright talked about this is a really important part of our existence, is creating and enjoying beauty, that had a powerful impact on me. You know, he didn't have to tell me twice about working for justice, because I always kind of have that ingrained in me to want to work, but this one was a little different. So, beauty, waste of time, right? Once again, Wright emphatically says, no, it is not. He has a quote here that I really like. He says, "The extraordinary ability to bring forth new life, supremely, of course, through begetting children, but in millions of other ways as well, is central to the mandate of the human race receives," I think that's a typo, "in Genesis 1 and 2, to make sense of and celebrate a beautiful world through the production of artifacts that are themselves beautiful, is part of the call to be stewards of creation," once again coming back to Genesis, "as was Adam's naming of the animals. Genuine art is thus itself a response to the beauty of creation, which itself is a pointer to the beauty of God." So, as you can see, you know, this is worth spending time on, and I would agree with them. When we look at Genesis, once again, if we're made in God's image, then we should also desire to create beauty and be a part of that beauty. You know, I think of those verses early in the creation story when he's creating the various things and he stops and says, this is good. You know, it's a clear affirmation that he enjoys creating beauty, and that's powerful, it's positive, and that we should too. I really like a metaphor that Wright uses. He talks about a violin. And he says God, you know, creates a violin, you know, metaphor for the world, and the violin itself is beautiful and it's great to look at, but he also creates it so that it can be even more beautiful when we interact with it. Because the best, you know, beauty of the violin is when the maker makes it so it can be played well, and then the player comes and plays it, and between the maker's sort of construction and the player's own skill and focus, you create the beauty of the music. And so that's kind of what he says is what he feels that's the world is for us. You know, God creates it, and we partake in it, and that's when we can really create the best out of it. So, enjoying and creating beautiful, you know, I think are very meaningful things that we should spend time on. J. Just like work, you know, to compare back Ecclesiastes, obviously that can be corrupted. If it becomes more about a self-centered pleasure chase than it does about worshiping and enjoying beauty in relationship with God and others, then it becomes fleeting. You know, I think that's what Solomon's really talking about in Ecclesiastes. Is he's talking about people who are looking to chase one pleasure after another, thinking this is going to be bring their entire meaning of their life is just feeling pleasure. And I think this is totally different. I think this is about building a relationship. When you enjoy beauty, you're connecting with God, and at times also connecting with other people when you enjoy it with those around them, and that's when it becomes very lasting. So, you know, enjoying beauty, nothing too edgy, right? I mean, we can't see anything that, you know, shows the brokenness of the world. I would say not exactly. I think it's important to remember, this is just sort of a more of a side note, but, like, I think beauty, if you're talking about, like, novels or works of art, like, they can reflect the world as it is. I think it's most powerful when you have a sense of hope there at the end. But I think of, like, Dostoevsky's, I love his novels because he doesn't shy away from the world. He shows it in as ugly and broken as it can be, but he finds hope in it, and that's what it is. And I do think sometimes, as Christians, sometimes when we create art, we sometimes want to sanitize it so it almost feels unreal. And that loses the impact, that loses the power of the hope when you feel like you're hiding these parts of humanity and you're not showing it all. So I don't know if that really has a ton of relevance overall to the message, but I just thought I'd throw it out there. I do think that's important. I think it's okay for us to watch a movie that maybe has some parts that are ugly or whatever, but, you know, but if it's got that message of hope, I think that still brings a lot of power to it. So I have a few examples I wanted to point out about beauty, too, that I think are just important to think about. This is, once again, as I was working on my sermon, I got on a little Facebook break. I'm sure you guys have all done that when you're working on stuff. And I just happened to stumble on my homepage on this photo by Brian Curlin. And I just think, I just thought at the time, I was like, that's so awesome. I mean, just simple as that. I was like, I'm really glad I had the opportunity to look at that. That's such a beautiful picture right there. And it was, you know, sort of a worshipful moment in the middle of my sermon, and to me, I was just like, yeah, I'm going to put that in there, because that's just one good example of, I'm glad that Brian took the time to go out and to, you know, find that bird and take that picture. It just shows the power that beauty can have. Another example, St. Paul's Cathedral in London. My family and I, we went on a trip to England, was that 3 years ago, probably?
Five,
oh my gosh, okay. About 5 years ago, we went to England, and I know something can be said for, like, you know, at a certain point it becomes a little much if we're spending tons and tons of money and resources to create, you know, cathedrals and stuff. Like, there's fair critiques on that, you know, because then you're losing resources to fight for justice and whatever. That's important, but I do think sometimes, to a certain extent, like, having some of these works of art, you know, these beautiful cathedrals, that are testaments and are built for the worship of God can be very powerful. And I know for me, I respond very deeply to these forms of beauty, a beautiful cathedral, and very sort of high form types of worship, high church, I guess, forms of worship. And I know, like, for me, me and my dad went to an evensong service, which is a choral service, when we were in England, and I just remember that being probably the most powerful worship experience I've had. So I would argue that the beauty of that was a really powerful moment in building my relationship with God. The beauty, to me, I guess, communicated sort of a feeling of holiness, a presence of holiness that was really powerful. And I remember thinking, as I was walking out, I was like, man, if I lived in England, I'd be so much more spiritual of a person. If I could go in here every day, like, for 30 minutes, that would be so awesome. But I think St. John's Catholic Church is a really beautiful sanctuary, too. And I like to go services there every once in a while. And for me, that's a really powerful experience because I feel like the beauty of the cathedral gives off that presence of holiness. But there are other ways also to worship in beauty. John Muir's cathedral. Okay, if you know John Muir, famous conservationist, writer, philosopher, you know, did a lot of stuff. He spent a lot of time in a lot of places out west, but Yosemite being the one he's most known for. This is Yosemite National Park. And he not just loved the beauty, you know, from a human standpoint, but he used it as a place to worship. and he spent a lot of time out there and would read his Bible, and he would pray, and, you know, that beauty was so, so pivotal to his experience of worshiping God that without that opportunity to enjoy that beauty, he wouldn't have got as much out of it. You know, I just, once again, highlighting how it can be so important, so pivotal in the way we worship. So, the last sort of section of this is the idea of heaven as worshiping God. Okay, that's something I think you hear a lot in Sunday school is, the idea of heaven is, you know, you're worshiping God throughout eternity. Okay, to 10-year-old Jason, I was like, oh, great. I was like, awesome, you know, like, I thought, like, that sounded boring to me. And part of that shows when you're 10 years old, you don't necessarily usually maybe have a real deep relationship with God. But also, I had a very constricted view of what worship meant. I thought that meant you were literally all times singing songs, you know, to God, and that was the only way you did it. But I think kind of a different view now. I do think corporate worship is incredibly powerful and important, and I think in heaven there will be corporate worship. But I kind of now think that also there's going to be time to worship in different, unique ways. That's kind of my view, that, you know, we're each endowed with different skills and interests, and I like to see heaven as a place where, you know, we can also use time to worship God in those ways as well. I kind of picture now that, you know, like, my dad can take some time to write in heaven, or the Suttons would be able to hike in heaven, or Seth would be able to complain in heaven. I'm kidding, of course. Yes?
Nicholas was asking me the other night if there would be video games in heaven.
That's great.
10-year-old.
Yeah, there you go. Perfect. I know where your head's at. Yeah. I was thinking the same thing.
Mario World song.
Yeah, no, I do. I think that once again we are endowed with these things that we're passionate about, and they're not. It's not necessarily bad. It can be corrupted, but it can also be a form of worship. And I like to see heaven as a place where we can do that. Last little thing then is there's a Jesuit priest and poet named Gerard Manley Hopkins. I really, really like him. I'm kind of throwing out all my favorites out here today. Wright, Buechner, and now Hopkins. He came up with this concept, for the next slide here, of inscape. And he believed that each aspect of creation has its own unique qualities and purpose on earth. And when we channel it and we live it out, we're instressing. Those are the two ideas. The inscape is that God created everybody unique, every creature and animal unique. And he believed that they were sort of given these qualities that have meaning and purpose. And once again, when you're in stress, it's when you kind of meditate, reflect those aspects, and then you use it as a form of worship. And I think that's, you know, a really powerful statement, I guess, of what I'm trying to get at here, is I think that we shouldn't necessarily shun the, you know, time spent on beauty and those kind of things, because God created that in us for a reason. We all have our unique skills, and that we should embrace them and enjoy them, and use them to be in relationship with God and to be in relationship with others. Okay? So, I guess when I think about heaven now, once again, is that worshiping is just interesting. Okay? It's interesting the beautiful things you like. It's interesting in the sense that if you're endowed with skills to fight for justice, that's, once again, I think a form of worship too. You're just living out your unique skills for God, and there's great power to that. And if we think of it that way, then I think worshiping God in heaven for eternity would seem like the ultimate joy and fulfillment. So that's all I've got. I will go ahead and pray us out, and we'll have a communion devotion. Lord, I just want to thank you for this beautiful, sunny morning that you've given us today, and that we can go outside, maybe not too long because it's cold, but, you know, go out a little bit and enjoy it and appreciate your beauty and be in relationship with you and with each other through that. I pray that, you know, as we go out this week and from here on, you would help us to not give in to the guilt that we can build up, or the fear, like the fig tree image of wanting everything to be, or just not knowing, you know, what we should spend our time on and getting paralyzed, but that you would just help us to build a relationship with you, and that through that, we would find a path that would be meaningful, fulfilling, and good for this world and good for those around us. Thank you for all that you give us. And I pray for everything else throughout this day that you would be in it. In your name I pray. Amen.